Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm coming off a rewarding visit to a place I'd like to recommend if you enjoy museums at all. For years, I've heard what a great place the Flint Institute of Arts is, and I took it in for the first time on Saturday and enjoyed every single room. It was a rich, diverse sampling of art spanning millennia. A terrific room of tapestries from the Renaissance was probably the highlight for me. Beautiful room, but you can't go wrong. The Flint Institute of Arts. And speaking of Flint, tomorrow we will learn more about an effort to clean up and revitalize the Flint riverfront with a couple of participants in that effort. This is, I guess you could say it's at least indirectly related to the Flint water crisis, but I'm led to believe that there's been altogether too much concrete put up near the Flint River, near downtown. They want to try to make it more accessible. There's a dam that's become kind of a problem in recent years that needs some work. So there's this effort that's taking shape in Flint to address the Flint riverfront. We'll learn lots more about that tomorrow here on Current State. At the top of our program, for a year, our first guest has been paying close attention to what's on the minds of people living here in the Lansing area. Matt Hund is engagement editor at the Lansing State Journal. His duties include writing editorials, which means staying closely connected to the issues affecting people living here in the capital city. In recent days, the LSJ has come out in favor of the Lansing School District's $120 million pathway promise millage and a moratorium on marijuana dispensaries. I sat down with Matt Hund to discuss some of these opinions and other aspects of his job. I first asked him about the paper's support for the Lansing School's Pathway Promise Millage, which the LSJ called a no-brainer. I asked him why.
We had quite a bit of research on this. We had a lot of people submitting their opinions and a lot of different groups specifically weighing in. And as traditionally before an editorial, we held an editorial board and we brought in the superintendent and the president of the school board, Yvonne Kamal Kanul and Peter Spatafor, and talked to them and asked them all the questions that we were hearing from the community. And they had 5 or 6 years worth of research to back it up and a lot of community outreach where they've been getting feedback all along. And it just sounded like a no-brainer.
The paper's preference aside, do you think the millage is going to pass? Do you get a feeling for that kind of thing at the paper?
The only real feeling that we get for it is how many people are writing in and how many different groups in the community are weighing in on it. And from all of the groups that I've heard, it sounds like it has tremendous support.
Most of the letters that I've read in the paper are in favor. An operational question here for you. Is the number of pro and con letters that you receive generally reflected in the balance that gets printed in the paper?
Yes, we try to print whatever we get as long as it's topical and it meets our criteria. So what you see is pretty much what we're getting.
Mm. So you're getting more letters supporting it. What's the ratio pro and con, would you say?
Oh, geez. We probably have only had a couple con, and they've basically been saying the same thing, but the number of pro maybe 15 or 20.
What have the cons been saying?
They basically are concerned with the exact amount of money that it'll cost, and I think that they're misunderstanding the figures a little bit, and they're not really clear on what it will be.
How do you determine which letters to publish? Talk to me about whatever a litmus test that you have there.
Yeah, we have a couple of criteria for letters to the editor. Obviously, one is length and space, and that's just a simple matter of we want to be able to print as many of them as we can. So we keep everybody down to 175 words. Then we give some preference and some precedence to those that are by local authors or on local topics or topics that are especially timely. Those tend to bump up the queue a little bit. But in my time there, I've been there almost a year now, we really haven't rejected very many. And the ones that we have tend to be ones that need to be referred either for fact-checking to a reporter or an accusation of crime or customer service. Sometimes we need to send it on to police or Better Business.
What's the most common reason you would reject a letter just immediately?
If somebody is using really kind of abrasive verbiage or is obviously very passionate with very little self-control, we specifically want to have letters in there that add value to the community, and somebody just caterwauling is obviously not going to do that.
Does that ever get close, though? Is that ever a close call between somebody who's really, really passionate about something and maybe it goes too far and maybe it doesn't?
It absolutely is a close call sometimes. And in those cases, I tend to call the author and say, listen, you know, it sounds like you're just kind of screaming a little bit. Okay. Maybe you could edit it and pull it back to something more valuable.
If you get tons more comments on one side of an issue, do you ever find yourself thinking, I wish we heard from somebody on the other side of this issue?
Absolutely. And specifically with our viewpoints, which some people call op-eds, those are our larger opinion pieces. Those can be up to 500 or 600 words, and they tend to run in a special section on Sunday. And that's really where we have the opportunity. If we think that we're only hearing one side of the issue, we might contact somebody who's very outspoken on that side and then specifically look for the other side and run them next to each other. The goal of the opinion page is now and always has been just to create the conversation and make sure that both sides are heard.
What do you think finally motivates a reader to write in with his or her opinion? You must have thought about that.
Yeah, you know, it's a question I ask myself quite a bit, because a lot of times it is a very specific subset of the population that's writing in, and I sometimes wonder if it's just the people who have extra time, but I do absolutely think that it's the people who have passion and who feel very strongly about an issue that when they see something, they decide to step up and go the extra mile and make the time.
Passionately for? Do you get more letters that are more passionately in favor of something or more passionately against something?
Well, that depends on if they're a letter about a politician or not. If it's a letter about a politician, it's usually passionately against. If it's about an issue, we get a fair mix of pro and con. Mm.
Matt Hund is engagement editor of the Lansing State Journal. We're talking about some recent positions taken by the paper and how the editorial page of the local paper of record operates. The LSJ also came out in favor of a medical marijuana ordinance and moratorium on new pot shops in Lansing. Why?
That was a simple matter of the fact that we are a local paper and we all live in the area and we all drive to work through the area. And we just see them cropping up everywhere. And then a reporter got a hold of some information about the fact that there was an ordinance in place that they were supposed to be being regulated and going through a licensing process, and it just simply wasn't happening. So between the watchdog reporting and what we were seeing in our own communities at home, we decided we needed to take a position on it. And we obviously don't have a problem with industry. We don't have a problem with business. And we don't have a problem with the legal sale of medical marijuana. But we do think that when there's a licensing and regulatory process in place, it needs to be upheld.
How do you arrive at the opinion that the paper will ultimately publish? What is that process like? How many people are involved?
Yeah, so it tends to come from either community tips or a reporter is covering a story and giving us a bunch of facts. And then we take it to what's called the editorial board, which consists of our president and publisher, our executive editor, our news director, and myself. And we sit down and we debate topics and see how we feel that the paper should fall on a certain issue. And
you bring the reporters into that, though, or not?
We tend to bring the reports into that as background information.
Their stories.
Yes, okay. Their stories. And if we need more background, sometimes after we have talked about that, we need further research, and I'll go talk to the reporter and do further research, ask more questions, see if there's an angle that hasn't been explored yet. We do extensive research online and through other sources also, and try to get the clearest picture that we can before we make a decision.
You've got more on your plate, I would take it, in a general election year than in other years.
Absolutely. We want to take positions on the proposals. We want to be a voice for the community and help everybody know what the facts and the ramifications will be. And then we also interview a lot of candidates and endorse in city election races and the mayoral race and several others.
Broadly, do you get more letters and op-ed possibilities from one side of the political spectrum than the other? I mean, broadly, I think Lansing is a blue community, I think, more liberal opinion. Do you get more liberal opinions from readers than conservative opinions?
That's hard to say. I actually believe that we get a fair mix. And I think a lot of times the reason why is because once we publish a letter, then we do allow people to write in and respond to that, especially if it's a response to a viewpoint. So we'll get somebody who's very passionate, say, on the conservative side of bathroom law legislation. Then the next few people who write in will be people who work for organizations that are specifically on the side of equality and equal rights and, you know, that side.
Did you publish an opinion on the State Board of Education, the transgender recommendations?
Only opinions from the community so far, but we did recently have in an editorial board some people who spoke about that. So that might be one coming up that we might want to watch for.
Did you endorse presidential candidates in the primaries?
No, we tend not to endorse in the presidential race. We're a much more locally focused paper, so we tend to do from the mayor down, if you want to think of it that way.
Not even the general election? No endorsement there planned?
Nope.
When we were arranging this interview, you referred to the new phenomenon of the engagement editor, which is your title. Remind us what's changed here. What's new in this position that wasn't there before? How has it changed?
Well, like I said, I've only had this position for a year, but I do think it's a very interesting position. I came from a journalism background a long time ago, and I saw that there's reporters and columnists and editors and copy editors and producers, and now there's this idea of engagement and community engagement and actually needing to get out there, meet with the people, sit with the people, eat with the people, you know, attend events with the people. And it's actually a really exciting role, and it ties in perfectly with the other half of the job, which is the opinion section. So every time I'm going out and talking with people and meeting with people, whether it's an event that we organized or it's an event that we're attending on behalf of the Lansing State Journal, we're always asking people for their opinions and for their ideas and story tips and all of that.
Describe the mood of the community, of the greater Lansing community, as you see it. I mean, there's an awful lot that's been made of how angry the electorate is in this presidential race. Do you see that reflected? What else do you see? What else do you pick up in terms of mood from local people?
You know, there is a bit of anger that's associated specifically surrounding politics right now. But the general mood that I see, and I'm very fortunate to see because I get to go to a lot of the events where we're building the community, it's a very hopeful, very excited mood. I think everybody in Greater Lansing is excited to see a lot of the changes that are coming around, a lot of the new developments. We have a huge craft beer industry, which was a story that we are working on for this weekend. There's just a lot that's building, and I think everybody is feeling the momentum.
Matt Hund is engagement editor of the Lansing State Journal. We're talking about some recent positions taken by the paper and how the editorial page of the local paper of record operates here. Anyone who reads the papers online or any journalism online where readers can comment, I think has been struck by the vitriol that has just become so prevalent in online commentary. What do you make of that phenomenon?
You know, there's this sub-phenomenon called trolling, and we definitely see trolling a lot where one specific person sinks their teeth into a story and just comments and feedbacks on every single piece of it that comes out. When you take those out of the equation, I think there is actually some good discourse, and there's a lot of people with good commentary on both sides. It's just sometimes wading through the vitriol.
How does online commentary compare to the letters that you actually get or maybe the emails?
I think that's a great question. I think the main difference is anonymity. People feel a certain amount of anonymity
they're
just throwing up something online. And I think that's something that really resonates with the idea of keeping letters to the editor and still having that available because those are all verified and everybody has to stand behind what they say.
Just a bit more shop talk here. Last week, Gannett, which is the Lansing State Journal's parent company, made official its interest in Tribune Publishing, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, and other papers, Baltimore Sun. I assume, does this get the attention of your staff?
I assume it does, but we haven't had much conversation about it yet. Being in Lansing, Michigan, we're kind of waiting for some of the larger players to come to the table. Mm. We do have the opportunity to comment and to listen to some of our Detroit Free Press colleagues talking about it, but there hasn't really been that much talk at the local level yet.
You do share a fair amount of content with the Free Press.
It's a fairly close relationship.
Matt Hund is engagement editor of the Lansing State Journal. We've been talking about some recent positions taken by the paper and learning more about how the editorial page and all of his other engagement activities work. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, we'll talk with one of the candidates for sheriff here in Ingham County this year, Eric Trojanowicz. Is a captain in the department. He's running as a Republican to replace the retiring sheriff, Gene Rigglesworth. And his opponent is the sheriff's son, Scott Rigglesworth. We'll get to know Eric Trojanowicz coming up on Current State. Lansing has had its share of criticism when it comes to its dining scene. Critics have said there's not enough to choose from or that the choices are boring. Former editorial editor at the Lansing State Journal, Mark Nixon, has been one of those critical voices in the past. He's now a contributor to the City Pulse, and he joins us here in Studio S today to discuss how he thinks the food scene in Lansing is changing. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Back in 2001, you created a little bit of a stir in a column for the LSJ. You called it, "Dinner is Yawn Served." What exactly did you say in that column?
Well, first of all, I said a few things that upset people, but what was surprising, all the editorials and all the columns I had written, that one probably garnered the most reaction, both positive and negative. Some of the restaurant people were unhappy, but a lot of their customers were saying, yeah, you're right. We need a little bit more adventure in our dining scene. Mm-hmm. That was 15, 16 years ago.
And recently in a City Pulse Dining Guide column, you reflected back on that column that you wrote for the State Journal, and you wrote about how things have changed since. In those 15 years, what changes have you seen?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think the dining crowd is just simply more adventurous, and I think, frankly, a little more worldly. They've had been exposed to a whole bunch of different kinds of cuisines. They travel more. So they're expecting more. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think you have a new generation of restaurant owners and chefs especially who expect more of themselves. And they see what they do in the kitchen is more than just churning out food. They see that it is sort of an artistic expression, a creative expression.
Mm-hmm. Who on the scene impresses you right now? Or that's a recent addition to the scene, let's say.
Well, I have several favorites, but probably the one that stands out to me is a place called The Cosmos. It's actually attached to a bar called Zuby's, so it's known as The Cosmos / Zuby's. It's an old town.
I was there Saturday night.
And how was it?
We did not make reservations. We went at the busiest, most crowded time, so we had to delay. We ended up going elsewhere, but can't wait to take it in.
They're like a lot of, I would call, smaller, almost, I wouldn't want to call them mom and pop places, but they're sort of like that. They're really pretty small operations, but they do some creative things. At The Cosmos, for instance, they have this bruschetta with a tomato relish and a triple cream brie. And I took one bite of that, and I just turned to my wife and I said, "France." Because I remember very distinctly having my first bite of really good cheese in France.
Okay.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. What else? What else is going on out there that impresses you?
Well, here's the thing that might surprise some people. Because people don't think of necessarily the Kellogg Center and the Stateroom in particular as being cutting edge. But I have to tell you, I think the people in that kitchen at the Stateroom are just doing wonderful things. And I think they're like some of these other places like the Cosmos. They are thinking fresh, they're thinking local, mm-hmm. and they're thinking seasonal. So, for instance, when I was at the Stateroom a few months ago in the wintertime, I had a parsnip apple bisque. Now, I don't know how often you've had parsnips. I haven't recently.
Every night, I'll have you know.
But the fact is they take something as seasonal. Parsnips. It's a root vegetable. You harvest them in the fall, and you make something creative with them. It was fantastic.
Red Haven hasn't been on the landscape that awful long. It created quite a bit of stir when it opened here a few years ago. What do you make of Red Haven?
Actually, it was the first restaurant I reviewed for the City Pulse a couple of years ago. But I will tell you that this almost epitomizes what I'm talking about. Fresh, local, seasonal. In fact, I think they even have T-shirts that say that. When's the last time you had French fries tossed with an egg yolk, sprinkled with lime juice, and scattered with thyme? It was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. They do, and they're very their specialties are small plates, at least that's been my experience, which I typically enjoy more than the big entree.
So. But what I'm hearing you say, Mark, is that you don't have to be a new establishment to become adventurous.
Absolutely.
It doesn't rule out. I mean, you might, an older establishment might have a clientele that's accustomed to a certain thing, but that's not preventing anyone from taking risks occasionally.
Absolutely. I think a perfect example of that, in fact, I wrote in this dining guide column a while back, a perfect example of that is the nightcap. I don't know if you're familiar with the nightcap.
Well, of course, and, you know, sure.
Where all the politicians and lobbyists used to hang out. As I said a couple of years ago, I think it had lost a step, but now it has some new owners and they're trying some new things. So even though they hold on to some traditional things like Oysters Rockefeller, they're trying some new things too. Again, they're going back to the fresh, the local produce from local farms, local meats, sometimes local farms, and thinking seasonal. I mean, you see beets a lot on their menu. That's that's sort of like parsnip, you know, beets, you know.
Yeah.
But it's exciting because they toss in some marinated onions and some goat cheese, and suddenly you've got yourself a wonderful meal.
It's a tough business. A fork in the road was unable to make it. What'd you make of their demise?
I was shocked. Of course, I don't know the backstory, but I thought that they had a fantastic following. I loved them. But, you know, as you said, it's a tough business and multiple things can happen. I, long time ago, I was in the restaurant business, so I kind of saw what it
you
was
were?
Like. Yeah.
What'd you do and when?
I was a server and a busboy, but that was like, you know, in the Stone Age practically. but I did see firsthand how tough it can be.
Oh.
To do this consistently and to have quality consistently. It's very, very tough.
For lots of places, it's an around-the-clock enterprise. It profit margins can be slim. I sometimes think to myself, it's a miracle we have as many restaurants as we do, because the work is so hard, it's so demanding, it's so competitive, and margins are so slim.
Yep.
It's really incredible in a way that there are as many restaurants as there are.
I think that
my own take on that, it's worth.
I agree. I think that what keeps people in the business is what we were talking about. This there is a creative expression that is involved in, and I think in restaurants that really want to do something that puts their signature on it. I think that the dining crowd really respond to that.
I think a lot of the people who tend to get into the business and start to be influential tend to be younger too. They're by definition bringing in new ideas into what's happening. So there's a evolution that's constantly taking place.
And there are a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them start out as these food trucks. I think Red Haven.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
What do you make of the food truck phenomenon, and do you enjoy that?
I do enjoy it. I wish I knew more about it. As I understand, and I may be wrong in this, this began on the West Coast in California, and it just kind of gradually kind of moved inland. And so, maybe 5-6 years ago or so, it landed in Lansing. I think it's a great alternative to just starting with a brick and mortar. It's probably, my guess is, it's a lot cheaper to get started. But in today's Lansing State Journal, there's a story about it. Guy started another food truck in Meridian Township, and he says this is great because he says it's just me in here and I have absolute control over the food product. So sounds cool.
I'm talking with City Pulse contributor Mark Nixon about his take on the changing dining scene here in Lansing. What do you think Lansing is still missing? I mean, what would you like to see pop up?
I think what I would recommend, and as I mentioned in this column, this recent column, I think that they ought to branch out and do some road trips, frankly, if they have the time. And I'm talking about not going to the other coasts or anything, but see what's happening in parts of Midtown Detroit. See what's happening in Grand Rapids and in Traverse City. Those have, I think, a phenomenal amount of really daring restaurants. I don't mean necessarily daring in the sense you have to be, you know, super fancy and everything, but they're using simple ingredients and putting them together in great ways. I don't know if you've heard of Selden Standard, which is a former laundromat, if I understand it, in Midtown Detroit, named by the Detroit Free Press as a restaurant of the year. And I was there about a month ago, and it's just you know, knock my socks off.
You get out on a regular basis now that you're not the editorial page editor at the LSJ anymore?
All I have to do to turn to my wife and say road trip, and she grabs her purse and we're on the way.
Yeah.
We do this.
Nice, nice. You just returned from several weeks in Europe. What were some of your more memorable food experiences there?
I have to say the first meal I had after we had landed was actually my favorite. And get this.
Boiled... It was at the airport.
No.
Don't tell me it was at the airport.
No, a little better than that. It was in a walled city in southern France. But if you can imagine boiled beans, you think, oh, how boring. Well, this is the French version. It's cassoulet. And this really goes to my point about keeping food simple. It was beans. They were boiled, but they were boiled with a lot of really cool spices and probably a lot of duck fat, and then finished off at the very end with a hunk of crispy duck, and it was fantastic. Very simple, but guess what? They've spent centuries probably perfecting those kinds of dishes.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded the mantra of Chris Johnson, who's associated with the Michigan Athletic Club as a trainer. Here, this just pops into my head, but Chris's mantra is perfect the ordinary.
Oh.
Perfect the ordinary. So that's really kind of what you're referring to there. A real basic dish, but that's dressed up in an interesting way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anthony Bourdain, the food critic, was at the Wharton Center a few years ago. I went to see him. And he said, I thought, something very profound. He said, the best cuisine is born out of necessity and poverty.
Mm. Yeah.
Very true.
I've been talking with City Pulse contributor Mark Nixon about the changing dining scene here in Lansing. Mark, welcome back home from Europe. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, we'll be chatting with Current sports host Al Martin about which MSU Spartans made their pro football dreams come true over the weekend in the NFL draft. Always fun when the Spartans and Wolverines play one another. The two competed on the diamond in a three-game set. We'll have a full recap coming up on Current State. Current State, three times daily here on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Among the decisions facing voters in Ingham County later this year, choosing a new sheriff. Longtime Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth has decided not to seek re-election. The Democrat in the race is his son, Scott Rigglesworth. The younger Rigglesworth is a lieutenant in the East Lansing Police Department. He appeared on Current State with his dad shortly after the sheriff decided not to run again. On the Republican side, a captain in the sheriff's department has entered the campaign, and he too comes from a law enforcement family. Eric Trajanowicz is the son of the late Bob Trajanowicz, who for many years ran the MSU School of Criminal Justice. Eric Trajanowicz joins me now to discuss his thoughts on policing and politics and the sheriff's post he hopes to occupy in January. Eric, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've been with the county sheriff's department for a quarter century. Broadly, talk to us about how that qualifies you to become sheriff.
I was hired at the Ingham County Sheriff's Office in 1991. I was hired as a road patrol deputy. I was assigned to our Out County Road Patrol, and I was also assigned to our Delhi Township Division. I was a field training officer, so I was assigned to train new officers that were hired with the Sheriff's Office. I was a community policing officer assigned to our Stockbridge Division. We policed the village of Stockbridge, and I was assigned down there. I was a canine handler also as a road patrol officer. I was promoted to sergeant in 1999, where I served as a road patrol supervisor for Out County Road Patrol, and I was also assigned to our Delhi Township Division as a road patrol supervisor.
And what qualifies you specifically to have the top job, do you feel?
I've been everywhere you can be in the Ingham County Sheriff's Office. I was either a supervisor in, I've been a supervisor in every division of the Sheriff's Office. I am presently a captain at the Sheriff's Office. I manage the day-to-day operations of our Field Services Division and also our Corrections Division.
Now, to be clear, you are retiring from the force. As an officer, help us understand exactly what's happening. You've been there 25 years. There's some talk of retirement here, but you're interested in the top job.
I am.
How does that play out?
I feel that what I've done at the sheriff's office has prepared me to take over as sheriff of Ingham County. I've been there 25 years. I've been loyal to the citizens of Ingham County. I'm very trustworthy. I retire on May 27th. That'll give me 25 plus years in at the sheriff's office. And then this summer, I'll just campaign and get out and meet the citizens of Ingham County.
You'd like the top job.
I would.
Let's discuss some of the issues and recent developments here. Body cameras, I know, has been one of them just in the past week or two. More body cameras have been deployed at LPD in the Lansing Police Department. What do you make of this trend? Is it a good one? Are we apt to see benefits from this?
I think it is a good one. The reason why I say that is it's cut down on our officer complaints, especially at the sheriff's office. When you tell someone when they call and want to complain on an officer and their demeanor or how the citizen was treated, and you tell them that the whole incident was videotaped on a body camera, they kind of change their tune. That it's worked to our benefit. Our lieutenants will review those from time to time to make sure officers are doing what they're supposed to do on the street. And if you wear a body camera, I mean, me as an officer, I was never afraid when I worked the road on people watching me or doing the right thing, because I always did the right thing. Mm-hmm. And you would expect your officers to be always doing the right thing. So for officers to have an issue with wearing body cameras, I don't think there should be an issue there.
In recent years, especially, it seems as if actions of the police have been subjected to more scrutiny and a lot more criticism. Do you think the deployment of body cameras is starting to reduce that criticism and will in the future?
I think so, because I mean, when someone has a body camera on and you look at the video, it's right there. It's
not. It doesn't lie.
Right, it's not hearsay evidence that you're trying to use against the officer. So, having that image helps a great deal.
Does the rank and file agree with that approach,
though? I think
is there resistance among the rank?
Some have resistance, but I think for the most part, people are in agreement that we should be wearing body cameras.
I know law enforcement is contending with heroin and opioid use, overdoses and abuse, perhaps like never before. It's become a huge problem. How do you view this more recent development?
With
heroin, opioid abuse, just that whole landscape. Deaths are up. There was an article in this morning's Lansing State Journal. Apparently, there's some number of people who want police officers to have more training in responding to heroin overdoses. And the whole landscape is just different than it used to be even a few years ago.
No, absolutely. And we respond differently to those types of cases, too. We have Narcan in every one of our patrol cars that the officers issued, which can bring someone back if they're having a heroin overdose. It'll bring them back. And at least
everybody on the force
absolutely.
Has access to Narcan.
And we've saved two or three lives in the last couple months just because of using Narcan to bring someone back. So I think that's a tool that has helped us in how we respond to those type of cases.
What's the way, how do we as a society deal with heroin and opioids? And what role do police play in that?
In our jurisdiction, when I started at the sheriff's office, we used to put 6 to 8 cars on the road. And as everybody knows, we've taken a huge hit when it comes to the budget. Now we're lucky to put out 1 or 2 cars on the road nowadays. So a lot of our drugs we used to get on traffic stops, which would lead us to the bigger sellers of the drugs. But now we're not putting cars out there, so we're not running into the drugs like we used to. So we can't get to the big supplier of the drugs.
Mm. How big an issue is meth in Ingham County?
It's a pretty big issue, but it's died down. I think heroin is the bigger drug in this area right now, especially between kids or people between the ages of 18 and 25 are the big users of heroin.
Should law enforcement's approach to either heroin or meth change in some way, in your view?
No, I think we work regionally. We have a meth team, so if we do come upon a meth lab, you'll see meth labs are more prevalent in the out county areas because of the smell that meth lab puts off. And when you're in a residential area, it alerts the neighbors. So that's why they tend to do it in rural areas. And we come upon a meth lab, there's a huge expense involved in breaking down a meth lab, and we have a regional team that a couple officers from our department are trained to come out and take down meth labs.
You feel like you've got adequate resources to deal with meth?
As of right now, yes.
Yeah. What about heroin? What about opioids? Do you feel like the county sheriff's office has adequate resources to contend with this?
Adequate resources. Then again, we go back to our road patrol issue. I feel with more road patrol on the street will help us better contain this issue.
Not enough patrols right now. I know historically it's been an issue.
It has been. Yeah. And obviously, as the county sheriff, you have to answer to the Board of Commissioners. They're the ones that set your budget, and they give you a certain amount of money, and you have to make do with the budget. But that's been a huge issue for a few years now, is not being able to put enough cars on the street.
So you'd like to see more dollars for that?
I would.
Yeah. Describe the current conditions at the Ingham County Jail here. Is that at capacity, near capacity, what?
Right now, we're just under capacity. We're 600 inmates is our capacity at the Ingham County Jail. And we've been under that for quite a while now. We did have a contract with MDOC, and they'd supply us a certain number of beds. And their end of the contract, they are not supplying us the inmates that we normally get. So that's why our bed space is down. But for the county beds, our beds are at capacity.
Does that pose a particular challenge? How big a challenge is that?
For being
so close to capacity.
It's always a challenge when you're at capacity or above capacity. When I first started as a captain there in 2014, we were over capacity just about every day, 25 to 30 inmates. And sometimes you run into situations on where we're going to house these inmates, and it becomes a real challenge.
What do you make of these stories involving police-related fatalities here in the United States in recent years? The Fergusons, the New York City incident, Eric Gardner, et cetera. Does that end up trickling down to the county level? How do you feel about that?
Yes, I think to a certain extent it does leave law enforcement with a bad name, and it does trickle down. I noticed at our place we'd get the complaints would go up during that period of time.
No kidding.
Around when something like that would happen. I think, truly believe it does affect the people at other police departments around the country.
Mm. Ingham County Sheriff's Department Captain Eric Trajanowicz is our guest. He's the Republican you'll see on the ballot in this November's election for Sheriff of Ingham County. What's your position on the department's? What's the department's working relationship with the Lansing Police Department?
We have a great working relationship with Lansing. Anytime I need something or we run into a situation, I have to talk to someone over there. I pick up the phone and call them, and their captains over there have my cell phone number, and I have their cell phone number. So if something happens after hours, and I just talked to their captain last week, he called me on a Sunday in reference to a situation we were having with an inmate, and we resolved the situation over the phone. We've had a great working relationship in my 25 years at the sheriff's office.
We've just got a minute left here, Eric Trajanowicz. What should voters take into consideration when deciding who the county sheriff should be? We got Scott Rigglesworth. What should people be considering here in this when they come to cast their vote?
I think the sheriff's office should be earned and not inherited. I've worked at the sheriff's office for 25 years. I've worked in every division of the sheriff's office as a supervisor. I know the inner workings of the sheriff's office. I know things that we can do to get more road patrol back on the street, maybe restructure the department a little bit. I'm trustworthy, loyal. I've served the citizens of Ingham County for 25 plus years. He works at East Lansing. He's been at East Lansing for...
He's familiar with the county, but he is with the city of East Lansing.
He is. I know where every township hall is in the county. I'm not sure that he knows where every township hall is in the county. I've patrolled in these townships for many years. I know the citizens in these townships. They're very supportive of me. I'm well-liked and I'm well-respected in the community.
Ingham County Sheriff's Department Captain Eric Trajanowicz has been our guest. He's running as a Republican to replace Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth, who will retire at the end of his current term. His opponent will be Democrat Scott Rigglesworth, a longtime friend and the sheriff's son. Should be interesting. Eric Trajanowicz, good luck. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me this morning.
This past weekend, the NFL draft returned to Chicago for the second straight year. The city's Auditorium Theater was the venue where the NFL dreams of 256 young men came true. Included in those 200-plus names were a few former Michigan State football players, and Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, joins us now here for more on the draft and a bit of baseball as well. Good Monday morning to you, sir.
Happy Monday, Mark. How are you doing?
Well, I'm just fine.
Good.
Tick through the names here for us. Who were the Michigan State players that were taken in this year's draft, and how good of a fit do they make on each of their respective new teams?
Well, let's just bear with me here, Mark. We had five Michigan State players who were drafted over the weekend out in Chicago in the NFL draft, and top 10 pick for Michigan State, offensive lineman Jack Conklin, he went number 8 to the Tennessee Titans. Defensive end Shalique Calhoun was next, number 75 in the third round to the Oakland Raiders. And a few picks after that, quarterback Connor Cook, number 100 in the fourth round to Oakland as well. So Calhoun and Cook will be teammates this upcoming year. At number 4, wide receiver Aaron Burbridge. He was the fourth Spartan to go at number 213 in the sixth round, the San Francisco, the 49ers. And offensive guard Donovan Clark, number 224 in the seventh round to San Diego. Now, interesting stat here, Mark. MSU is one of 5 schools to have at least one player chosen every year since the inception of the draft, which dates back to 1967. The other schools, of course, the school down the road, U of M, Florida, Nebraska, and USC. And there were also 8 free agents that were signed as well, Mark. You had center Jack Allen. He will be headed to the New Orleans Saints. Wide receiver DeAnthony Arnett to the Seattle Seahawks. Cornerback Arjun Calhoun to the Dallas Cowboys. Linebacker Darian Harris to the Cincinnati Bengals. And Darian, also a former Current Sports intern back in the day.
Shout out to Darian.
I know, right? Exactly. Pretty cool to see him make his NFL dreams come true. Defensive tackle Joel Heath to the Houston Texans. Fullback Trevin Pendleton to the Baltimore Ravens. Long snapper Tabar Pepper to the Baltimore Ravens. And Lawrence Thomas to the New York Jets.
So we've got 2 Spartans who will continue to be teammates in Calhoun and Cook. There was a lot of speculation over when Connor Cook would go. What do you make of the way that unfolded? He was not a first-round pick.
A big mess, Mark. And the reason I say that is because when you look at Connor Cook's body of work, Connor Cook's quarterback resume stacks up, if not trumps, just about every quarterback who went over the weekend in Chicago. And, you know, we had this conversation multiple times leading up to the draft last week on Current Sports. The big reason why Connor Cook fell this far in the NFL draft had to do with questions of his leadership ability, and more so specifically, him not being named a captain throughout his Michigan State career in his senior season. And, you know, I really believe, Mark, and we'll elaborate on this later on Current Sports Radio, but there were a few NFL scouts and upper personnel who decided to come out under condition of anonymity, and they let it be known that Connor Cook's leadership was so questionable that they didn't believe that he should be a first-round pick. Just to read a few quotes here. This is coming from Tom Pelissero of USA Today. He wrote an article entitled Connor Cook Leaves Some Teams Uneasy in the NFL Draft, in which he talked to a few anonymous NFL scouts. And here's what a few of them had to say, really briefly, Mark. Quote, "There's something off," said an NFL quarterback's coach, one of many in the league who have spoken to Cook and gave their impressions to USA Today Sports on condition of anonymity for competitive reasons. Quote, "There's something about him that you just don't trust him." Here's another quote, Mark. Quote, "I don't mind the kid at all. I'll take a kid who wins games over a nice guy who loses games. But there's something missing with him." And one last one for you, Mark. Quote, "There's just something push-offish about him." I don't even know what that means. But he goes on to say, quote, "It appears to me I could be dead wrong, but he'd be a guy that when he got in the locker room, they'll try to eat him up and spit him out," end quote. Those, at the end of the day, Mark, were damning quotes that really hurt Connor Cook and caused him to fall in this draft.
Well, I mean, are they referring to the fact that he was never captain?
That's the premise
of
it.
So, I mean, anybody with that distinguished of a career in East Lansing would have been named captain at some point, and there are reasons he wasn't named captain.
Exactly. Well, it's a team vote at the end of the day, and the team felt as though there were other personnel on that squad that had, I guess, better leadership qualities than Connor Cook. But naturally, when you play the quarterback position at a Big Ten school, Mark, you are a leader. Whether you got that C on your jersey or not, you are a captain. So, but at the end of the day, that hurt Connor Cook. And, you know, and Mark D'Antonio, he had a teleconference in which he addressed the media when concerning which players were chosen. And, you know, and I was very shocked that it didn't come until the third question where they asked Mark D'Antonio about his comments on Connor Cook falling in the draft. And Mark D'Antonio was very displeased. And I'll get to his quotes later on this afternoon. Mm.
What were your biggest surprises in this year's draft? Did anybody go earlier than you thought? Did anybody else sit around and wait a long time to be taken?
Well, I tell you what, Mark, I got to give a shout out to the Lions. I thought the Lions did a pretty good job in this year's NFL draft. Bob Quinn, the rookie GM for the Detroit Lions, the offensive line has been a problem for the Lions these past 2 years. They've ranked in the bottom barrel of the league when it comes to that offensive line. And when it comes to the defensive line, they have lacked depth. That's the big thing. And they drafted Ohio State offensive tackle Taylor Decker at 16th overall. They drafted a lineman in the second, third, fifth, and sixth round. That's four linemen in the first five rounds and five overall, of course. Get this, Mark. Detroit hadn't drafted a lineman in the same draft since 1989. And even that year, they only took one in the first four rounds. So I really like what the Lions did. Bob Quinn is addressing needs, and that's exactly what you want to do in the draft. Also, the Jaguars. Watch out for the Jacksonville Jaguars. They went heavy on defense in this year's draft. That's impressive. The Jets puzzled me in drafting Penn State quarterback Christian Hackenberg. They now have four quarterbacks on that roster, and the Browns with 14 picks, which match the most picks for one NFL franchise in draft history. And in those 14 picks, they drafted five wide receivers. So, yeah, interesting stuff there, Mark. Mm-hmm.
The Tigers, speaking of Detroit teams, are on something of a win streak here. Five games in a row, and they swept the Twins over the weekend to take a road series. What's going on with Detroit? They're doing something right. They're winning.
I tell you what, Mark, it amazes me how reactionary we are in the sports world, because, first off, in the baseball season, you have 160-plus games, right? And just a week ago, we were in panic mode because the Tigers won a bit of a losing streak. And now we're singing an entirely different tune on this Monday morning, right? But Nick Castellanos, I mean, he leads the AL in batting right now. He came up huge for the Tigers, able to give them that edge in that win against Minnesota yesterday. Hit a three-run homer to left field. Mike Pelfrey, another iffy start for Mike Pelfrey, Mark. He has not been great for the Tigers thus far, even though it is early. But I do think the clock is ticking on Pelfrey with guys like Mike Fulmer, Matt Boyd, Daniel Norris waiting to come up, of course, and start for this team. So that's an interesting story that's unfolding right now. But five straight wins for the Tigers, six of the last seven. And get this, I've always harped on the bullpen. Many of us has when discussing this Detroit Tigers team.
Right.
The bullpen was great this past weekend, Mark. They didn't allow a run. This entire weekend. Throw a party, Mark.
Outstanding.
That's fantastic.
It's always great when the Spartans beat U of M. Speaking as a homie here. in baseball, we took 2 out of 3 over U of M this weekend.
Yes.
What gave MSU the edge?
Well, I tell you what, this team can hit, Mark. So impressive at the plate. And, you know, I want to give a big shout out to Jordan Zimmerman, who went 2 for 4 yesterday. And also Dan Durkin, he went 3 of 4 yesterday. He was absolutely fantastic. But this team is so efficient at the plate. And that's what amazes me about this team. They had 5 different Spartans who drove in runs yesterday. And now, of course, it's finals week. They don't play until this Saturday. They have a 3-game set starting on Saturday, bleeding into Monday. But this team is so impressive from top to bottom, Mark.
Always fun to watch offense. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, here at weekdays at 1 p.m. on AM 870 WKAR, Current Sports TV, which airs every Thursday night at 10:30. On WKAR-TV. Have a great week, Al. Good to see you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate that.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, state, city, and federal bodies have been addressing the Flint water crisis. Meanwhile, other groups want to transform the Flint riverfront to clean up contamination and enhance economic prosperity. We will talk with a couple of key players in that movement. That and more Tuesday here on Current State. Peter Worf's our executive director. Thanks to Katie Cook, who directed the show today. Also, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Have a great day. We'll be looking for you Tuesday on Current State.